Good morning. Welcome to the September session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. My name is Frankie Moore. I'm from North Platte, and I'm joined on the bench to my left by Judge Larry Welch from Plattsmouth. And we're joined via WebEx video conferencing with Judge Bishop here in Lincoln. We do appreciate your following our protocols. We are glad to be back here live to the extent folks are comfortable being live and able to be live. So we do appreciate you following the protocol by wearing your mask in. When you come to the bench for your argument, you may remove the mask. And when you're finished and return to council table, please put it back on, and then we'll have you exit by the side door there when you leave, and our cleaning crew will come in before the next argument. So that's our new way of doing business for the moment. So with that, this case is Yeider versus Barber, and Mr. Higgins, when you're ready. Let's see. Oh, I have the wrong sign-in sheet. I'm so sorry. In re Interests of Kiara J. So appellant, when you are ready, you may approach. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Mary Rose Donahue. I'm an assistant public defender at the Douglas County Public Defender's Office. I'm here on behalf of the appellant Kwame Jackson, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I have three assignments of error in this matter. I would like to focus on the third assignment of error, whether or not it was in Kiara's best interest for her father's parental rights to be terminated. Of all the witnesses that the state called at this termination of parental rights, not one of them provided any meaningful information regarding Kiara. Case law is clear that even if the state meets their burden on the subsections of the basis of the termination of parental rights, ignoring best interest is not enough to terminate a parent's rights. The state relied heavily on Paige Worley, a caseworker for the family, for the 5 months that the case was open. She offered, there was an exhibit, Exhibit 19, which was offered and received, which laid out the documents she reviewed informing her opinion for termination of parental rights for not only Kiara, but her other two siblings involved in the case, and any conversations that she had. There is no mention of Kiara's name on that document, and her testimony is completely devoid of any information regarding Kiara. She testified regarding past intakes. Kiara's name is never mentioned in that history. It's unclear if Kiara was present during any of those intake concerns or if she was even alive. The visitation.
Excuse me. Wouldn't you agree that the termination provisions provide for consideration of other acts affecting other children who may be under the custody or protection of the parent at issue? And in this case, it was a sister of Kiara's who was hurt quite seriously.
Yes, Your Honor. I would direct the court's attention to In re Ryder J from 2012, which has somewhat similar facts in that the parent was accused of harming a sibling of the child whose parental rights were at stake. In that case, however, the court did uphold the termination, finding that the evidence at trial that was adduced was that the parent in that case, the psychologist testified that parent should not be left alone with any child and would need extensive work. We do not have any of that information in that case. Essentially, this case was completely silent as it relates to Kiara. And although I think I think that it was clear in that case that even if a court finds that the actions taken on behalf of the parent were true, that is gravely concerning. The state is still required to take the next step of establishing best interest for that child. And in this case, I believe the state failed to do so. When you look at going through the transcript, there's probably less than 20 mentions of Kiara's name overall. And when it is, it's merely in relation to her older sister or younger sister. There's not a single mention of her mental health, her medical health, her development, whether she's in daycare, whether she has any special needs. It is simply silent. Merely, this case notes that Kiara exists. and that she has two sisters. Beyond that, I don't know how the court can find in re Ethan D. The court held that the juvenile court nor the Nebraska Supreme Court for de novo review had the information necessary to make the determination regarding the minor child's best interest, regardless of whether that info is prior to the filing, during the time that it was pending, or at the time of the TPR, and that the state failed to present evidence directly adduced from people most able to testify to the child's condition, circumstances, and best interests. I would argue that that's very similar in this instance here.
Isn't the case that you're citing to the Ryder case, don't they very clearly say that the abuse of any child by an adult, regardless of whether it's the adult's own child, calls into question that adult's ability to parent?
I do think that it absolutely states that it is cause for great concern. My reading of that case was that the court said that there was evidence that established that particular parent would not be a safe parent going forward for his particular child. This case, no such evidence exists. There's no such evidence that any examination was done of Mr. Jackson, that there's any outside info other than sort of the 5 months that's captured in this case.
So if I can interrupt you for a second, you're not talking about there being insufficient evidence as it relates to the abuse involving the sibling. I think it was Kai Lynn. Your position is, even if there was significant abuse here to Kai Lynn, that you needed more evidence to suggest that then poses a danger to the other sibling. It's not inherent. If you abused one child, you may very well be dangerous to the other. You need more evidence to establish that there's actually a danger to the other child. Is that your position?
My position is that, number one, there was assignments one and two, assignment error one and two. I do allege that there was insufficient evidence to adjudicate and to meet the burden of the subsections that the state alleged. In the alternative, even if the court does find that the state met their burden, there's still the best interest prong. I mean, even in the state's own brief, they say that that's a independent, fact-specific, fact-intensive inquiry. I don't know what facts. I mean, I think that the court has been faced with issues before, and the Nebraska Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals has never gone so far as to say simply abusing one child in and of itself inherently is in the best interest of another child to terminate parental rights. I would draw the court's attention to in Kenneth C. versus Lacey H. It's a 2013 case. I understand it is a paternity action. However, in that, the Nebraska Supreme Court reversed a district court's termination of parental rights, of a father's rights in the paternity action, citing that the mother had proven the abandonment portion, but did not prove in best interest. And they did cite in re Ethan D. in that matter. So I know it's not a juvenile court case, but they did pull in Ethan D. And so I do think that would be analogous to this, is that the court did find in that case the father did abandon the child. However, there was no evidence or not enough evidence to establish that it was in the best interest of the child.
Excuse me, is it your position that courts have to wait until a person in this situation actually injures his own child?
No, my position is that it is the state's burden always, and that is the state's burden to adduce some evidence more than just a child exists to do it, to terminate a parental's right, a parent's right.
Wasn't there evidence that the older child testified, or not testified, but talked to a therapist about this father hitting the mother until she bled, that he stepped on her face. And now we have a situation where he has seriously injured this infant. Can't a judge in the courts take all of that into consideration to determine whether this father is unfit to parent his daughter, because he's a risk, and there's a great risk that he could hurt his child?
I think that the court could absolutely factor it. I do think, however, I believe that was through the older sister's therapist where the majority of that testimony came out. Again, very unclear. I believe the age difference of these children at the time of the TPR, the older sister was 7, possibly 8, and Kyari was 3 years old. It was very unclear. Was Kyari born? Was she present for that? Did she even exist? Again, the record is devoid of that. I think it's always the state's burden to prove that, and there simply was just not evidence of what, if anything, Kyari was affected by. Thank you.
Question quickly, is your paternity case you mentioned cited in the brief?
It is not, Your Honor. I could give you the case. I could give you the.
Yeah, that would be great.
Thank you. Please.
286 NEB 799.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Tony Hernandez. I am a deputy county attorney with Douglas County Attorney's Office, and I represent the appellee. I'd first like to ask this court to affirm the trial court's ruling, finding that the state did prove by clear and convincing evidence that one of the sub-allegations under 43-292 was proven by clear and convincing evidence, and that best interest was also proven by clear and convincing evidence. The state would then ask that the court find that 292 subdivision 9 was not specifically argued as required by the appellate courts. It was specifically assigned as an error, but as demonstrated in the appellant's brief on page 18 and the first end of the first paragraph, it jumped from count 2 to the second paragraph, jumped to count 4. Then the third paragraph jumps to count 5. And the only reference to subdivision 9 in the appellant's brief is in reference to whether reasonable efforts were provided. And the state would ask that since the appellate courts require that an error be specifically alleged and specifically argued, that the court not address whether the state found by clear and convincing evidence whether reasonable efforts or whether aggravated circumstances were present, and proceed to the analysis on best interest. But should the court decide to do an analysis as to whether the state proved by clear and convincing evidence a sub-allegation of 292, the state would argue that the evidence clearly demonstrates clear and convincing evidence that the state proved subdivision 2, that the parent has continuously and repeatedly failed to provide care for the child, and the state would point to in reinterest of Chloe and Ethan L. As a finding supporting that, where the parent.
Mr. Hernandez.
Yes, Your Honor.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but I'm wondering if you could jump to 292.10 with regard to the court's finding that subdivision would apply. Is there anything in the record that would indicate that Kylin is actually this father's child or this person's child?
Your Honor, the state was not going to be arguing that the state proved by clear and convincing evidence that subdivision.
Okay, so you would concede the court may have erred in that regard?
Yes, Your Honor, there was evidence that he acted in a parental role, but as to a legal tie through some sort of legal determination of paternity, the state erred in filing that sub-allegation.
But there, would you agree there's nothing in the record to establish paternity of Quamaine over Kylin?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Back to subdivision 2 analysis, the state argues that they did, significant evidence was presented. Dr. Haney testified to the injury. She talked about the diagnosis of trauma and then determining whether it was accidental versus abusive. Through her analysis and her algorithm of determining a diagnosis, it was determined that due to the lack of any other information provided designating that it would be an accidental injury, the result is an abusive traumatic head injury. Detective Lisa Crouch provided the evidence that demonstrated that the appellant was in sole possession and control of the child.
So I'm going to ask you to, if you would you jump to her specific argument here today, which is assuming that there's evidence that there was harm or abuse to one child, there has to be more evidence as it relates to there being a risk to the other, as I understand it. What's the state's position in that regard?
Your Honor, the state, in reinterest the WCO, while that wasn't an adjudication regarding a father who sexually abused a child, in that case, the Supreme Court found that a parent who sexually abuses one child is a risk to all children. In reinterest of Gavin S., that was a parent two parents who were providing childcare to Zachary, who died in their care, and the court terminated their parental rights to their own children due to the fact that there was no explanation for the injuries. The injuries would not have been suffered through normal care of a child, and that the child died while in the parent's care, and that due to that, there was no ability to create a rehabilitative plan because there was no acknowledgement of any wrongdoing on the parent's part. So how do you create a rehabilitative plan to correct no wrongdoing? And that any rehabilitative plan was too substantial of a risk to the children because a rehabilitative plan is put in place in order to facilitate reunification. And that reunification, due to the fact that there was no explanation for the injuries in Gavin S., the injuries were so severe that any plan was too high of a risk to place those children back in their parents' custody. So a rehabilitative plan was not necessary. That's the state's argument in this.
But was that language or rationale in connection with the best interest problem?
Yes, Your Honor, that was in the best interest. In the last two paragraphs, the court designated those two paragraphs to talk about the best interest, that it is not in a child's best interest to have a rehabilitation plan to facilitate reunification with a parent who has already demonstrated their ability and willingness to severely abuse a child such that the child has to have part of their skull removed in order to release the blood and the pressure on the child to relieve the seizures that they were suffering. And that has then led to a lifelong diagnosis of cerebral palsy for the child.
Do you think that if this father would have admitted that he did this thing and that it was a terrible accident and that it wouldn't happen again and he wanted to get help and treatment, would we have a different situation from the state's perspective?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Depending on the circumstances and the facts, if the father came in and with a reasonable explanation as to some sort of deficiency within himself that the court could then order a rehabilitative plan to correct, that would be a completely different circumstance. In this circumstance, it was 6 months before the trial came, and at that point, no explanation had ever been given. No acceptance of any responsibility had ever been acknowledged. The defendant could have, the appellant could have placed himself on the stand and threw himself at the mercy of the court and provided some sort of reasonable explanation. There was no evidence presented that the father had accepted any type of responsibility or acknowledged any need for a rehabilitative plan in order to correct a deficiency that led to the child in his care having to have part of their skull removed in order to save the child's life. So I would argue that, and in the testimony, Paige Worley, who did provide the best interest explanation, did testify that in her opinion, there is a point in which a parent subjects a child to such egregious injuries that there is no level of trust that can be garnered in order to trust the parent not to inflict that same injury on another child. There is a point in which an injury is so egregious that the parent sacrifices their ability to be able to have a rehabilitative plan.
Whose testimony was that? I'm sorry.
Paige Worley, Your Honor. It was at the end of her testimony, direct examination. Redirect, I apologize.
Okay. Did that witness go so far as to say in this particular, in their opinion, this is one such case?
Yes, Your Honor. That was a direct question.
So you would take the position that that is evidence of direct evidence that the amount of damage here, the amount of abuse here doesn't just relate to the child, but relates to the other siblings.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. That was a direct question by myself to Paige Worley. And with that, Your Honor, I conclude my arguments, and I would ask again that this court find that the trial court was correct in finding by clear and convincing evidence that the state did prove its case, subdivision 2 and subdivision 9 of 43-292, and found those allegations true, and that the state did prove by clear and convincing evidence that it was in the best interest of Kayari to have the appellant's parental rights terminated, and also that the state did prove by preponderance of the evidence that Kayari does come within the meaning of 43-247-3A. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The appellant has a minute 37 remaining.
Thank you. I do believe before I did forget to ask the court that Mr. Jackson is asking the court to reverse the juvenile court and vacate its December 9th, 2019 order and remand for further proceedings. In response to Mr. Hernandez's argument regarding best interest, his argument that the analysis is whether a rehabilitation plan could be put into place. While I do concede that the statements that he laid out regarding towards the end of Ms. Worley's testimony are accurate, during the cross-examination that I had of her, when I asked her, is there any negative impact that Kyari would have, any negative impact on Kyari's life if reasonable efforts were provided to the parents, she said no. So while she also makes that statement to Mr. Hernandez, she concedes to me that there is no negative impact on this child if reasonable efforts were to be provided. Ergo, parental rights would be intact. I think that it's burden shifting to allege that the father could have testified and laid out a plan. This entire trial is the state's burden, always has and always has been. I think that, again, the state did not touch on it at all. There is this court nor the juvenile court has any information about Kyari J. There is not a single piece of information that has been provided to humanize this child, to show what how she is different from her siblings, any other child, what her specific needs are, her bond with her parents. This witness testified that she had no idea what the bond was. It would be helpful, but it wasn't her job to look into that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. You are excused and your case is submitted. And again, I just ask that you proceed out of the side door when you're ready.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, of course.
Thank you.
Thank you.